of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is his. Who is he that can intercede with him but by his permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of his knowledge except what he pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and he is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran says a recent Israeli-U.S. declaration against Tehran is also aimed at securing Israel's hegemony over Islamic and Arab states. Palestinians stage a rally in the besieged Gaza Strip to voice their opposition to a U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to the Israeli-occupied territories. And Italy is facing a political crisis as Prime Minister Mario Draghi tenders his resignation. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran says there will be no peace and stability in the West Asian region as long as protecting the security and superiority of Israel is a priority for the U.S. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said Iran considers its neighbor's security as of its own security. He also pointed to the recent declaration by the Israeli and U.S. leaders of putting anti-Iran stance on their agenda. He noted that the declaration is aimed at targeting not just Iran, but securing Israel's hegemony over Islamic and Arab states. The statement was signed during U.S. President Joe Biden's trip to Tel Aviv. Washington has reiterated that it remains committed to Israel's security, especially the regime's qualitative military edge in the region. Saudi Arabia says that it will allow all carriers to use its airspace if they meet the country's requirements for overflying. The kingdom says the move aims to consolidate its position as a global hub connecting three continents. The decision would lift overflight restrictions on airlines traveling to and from Israel. The U.S. has praised the move, calling it the result of President Joe Biden's principal diplomacy with Riyadh. Saudi Arabia made the announcement hours before Biden's arrival there from Israel on the second leg of his regional tour. Saudi Arabia's lifting of flight restrictions to Israel is seen as an apparent gesture of openness towards the regime. Back in 2020, several Arab states, including Bahrain and the UAE, normalized ties with Israel. Palestinians have rallied in the Gaza Strip to slam U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to the occupied territories. Biden has been expressing his full support for the Israeli regime since taking office. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have condemned U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to occupied Palestine. Scores of people in the blockaded enclave protested against Biden's visit while shouting slogans in support of resistance actions against the occupying regime. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Tel Aviv on Wednesday to kick off his first trip to the region since taking office. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas accused Joe Biden of putting the interests of the Israeli regime ahead of the legitimate rights of Palestinians and regional security.
The President of the United States of America carries nothing but unlimited support for the Zionist entity, its security and prosperity, and a package of false promises to the Palestinians. The United States' adoption of Zionist plans is based on uprooting our people from their land by force and obliterating their identity and history in favor of the Zionist entity.
During his trip to the occupied territories, Joe Biden visited U.S.-funded missile interception systems, including the so-called Iron Dome and Iron Beam. The Islamic Jihad movement says the U.S. administration only aims to prolong the Israeli occupation and support its aggression against the Palestinian people.
Joe Biden's visit comes to serve the interests of the Zionist entity, and he's not welcomed in our land. We believe that the U.S. and the Zionist regime share the same interests. Joe Biden has ignored the suffering of the Palestinian people and continues to support the Zionist regime.
Palestinians have warned against the dangers of Biden's agenda and the attempts to integrate the Israeli regime into the region and expand the circle of normalization with it. Analysts said all U.S. administrations have adopted the same biased policy towards the Israeli regime.
When it comes to Israel and Israeli security, there is no difference at all between Republicans and Democrats. What we are witnessing today is that Democratic President Joe Biden support for the deal of the century and his support for further normalization between Israel and the Arab countries.
Palestinians are calling on the free people of the world to reject the arrogance and policies of the United States that target the region's security and stability.
Observers say that Joe Biden's visit will only give the Israeli regime the green light to further violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's foreign ministry has summoned the Swedish charge d'affaires in Tehran to lodge strong protests over a Swedish court's life sentence ruling for Iranian national Hamid Nouri. Iran called the ruling illegal, that violates international law and sovereignty of states, adding that the court lacked jurisdiction to the case. Iran's ministry said the evidence presented in the court was provided by MKO, a terrorist group which is behind the killing of over 17,000 Iranians. It also slammed the Swedish court for giving a platform to terrorists and that the ruling was in effect an attempt to whitewash the MKO's terror activities. The ministry further noted that Hamid Nouri has served 2 years illegal incarceration and called on Sweden to immediately release him. Tehran says Nouri has gone through various physical and mental pressures in solitary confinement that amounts to torture in violation of basic human rights. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has dismissed the Swedish court ruling in the case of Iranian national Hamid Nouri.
The Islamic Republic of Iran strongly condemns this political statement, which makes way for baseless and fabricated accusations against Iran and its judicial system, and contains the life sentence against Hamid Nouri.
Nasser Kanani also said the verdict was a pretext for political action without substantiated evidence and legal validity. Kanani said the court ruling shows Sweden is a safe haven for terrorist groups to operate with the support of the judicial system. Earlier, the Swedish court handed down a life sentence to the Iranian citizen. Hamid Nouri was arrested in 2019 over allegations of human rights violations against MKO members back in the 1980s. Last month, in a short phone call with his family, Nouri said that He was tortured while in prison and denied medical attention despite deteriorating physical condition. Torrential rains continue to wreak havoc in several Indian states, killing nearly 24 people and displacing millions more. The fresh deluge in Maharashtra state has caused riverbanks to burst and sewage to flood homes. Shops in many cities are closed while thousands of residents are evacuated. The Weather Department has issued a red alert for several districts. At least 18 people, including 6 children, have been killed in that state. Rains have also been lashing Tenanga state for the past 6 days, with rivers and reservoirs receiving heavy inflows. Several bodies, including those of rescue personnel, have been found there. The floods have destroyed farmlands and interrupted communication. Extreme weather in India has become more frequent in recent years, which environmentalists blame on climate change. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has offered his resignation after a rift with the Five Star Movement. President Sergio Mattarella has refused Draghi's resignation in a bid to overcome the political deadlock. Max Civilli reports.
On Wednesday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi announced his resignation at the end of a bruising day in which his executive survived a confidence vote on a cost-of-living bill in the Senate, with one of the biggest parties in the government alliance, the Five Star Movement, abstaining from voting. In a statement, Draghi said that the pact of trust at the base of the government's action and the conditions to carry out the executive's program no longer exist. However, President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella rejected Draghi's resignation in an attempt to break the political impasse, inviting the former European Central Bank president to address Parliament and to assess the situation.
I have already said that there won't be a second Draghi government. Let me say, this executive has dealt with the ongoing tensions pretty well.
The Five Star Movement pooled its support for the Draghi government over a bill aimed at helping businesses and households with skyrocketing energy prices and a provision for a trash incinerator in Rome, a project the once anti-establishment party staunchly opposes. The Mario Draghi government was formed after ex-Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte's second executive collapsed in February 2021. Draghi was appointed to address the consequences of the pandemic and to manage about 200 billion euros in grants and low-interest loans from the European Union for a radical restructuring of Italy's economy.
As usual, Draghi destroys the small and medium enterprises and destructure the economy rather than restructure it. The perspective is to transform the Italian economy in a weakened economy that will be a sort of ground for big multinational companies.
Italian President Mattarella takes on a central role now. It's up to him to decide whether to try to persuade outgoing Prime Minister Draghi to form another executive, find a new caretaker leader to take the country to an election next year, or call an early elections in September. October would be an unprecedented event in Italy's political history, as in the autumn, the government generally needs to prepare and pass its budget. Max Civilli, Rome.
Serbia's president has accused the West of fighting a world war against Russia by means of Ukrainian soldiers. In a TV interview, he said that the Ukraine conflict is a global one, as the entire Western world is fighting against Russia via Ukrainians. He stressed that all the talks, that is a regional or local conflict, must be dropped. The Serbian leader warned that the situation in Ukraine is also affecting the Balkans. He vowed, however, that Serbia will spare no effort to preserve peace in the region. Russia launched its military offensive in Ukraine in February, saying that it has no plans to occupy the country, but to demilitarize it. Moscow accuses the West, the U.S., in particular, of adding fuel to the flames by sending lethal weapons to Ukraine. Sri Lanka's parliament has accepted the president's resignation 2 days after he fled the country following a months-long protest. The president sent his resignation via email from Singapore on Thursday. The prime minister will now become the acting president until parliament elects an MP to succeed him. The parliament speaker says that the process will take place quickly. Last week, protesters angry at the spiraling economic crisis stormed the president's residence and office in Colombo. They blamed him for the crisis that has made extremely difficult for Sri Lankans to buy food, fuel, and medicine. The protests have been ongoing since March. The demonstrators say they want the change of the whole government system. And the European Commission presents a gloomy economic forecast for the 27-nation EU. Western sanctions being imposed on Russia are pushing up the cost of living for millions of citizens, Jerome Hughes reports.
The EU's tourism industry is currently thriving, but make no mistake, businesses facing huge overheads are struggling to turn a profit. In its summer economic forecast, the European Commission has revised growth downwards and inflation upwards. The bloc is concerned Russia is going to turn off all its gas supplies.
This risk has become more than just a hypothetical scenario for which we need to prepare. So a storm is possible.
For millions, the storm is already here. Governments are accused of not providing support to deal with the cost of living crisis arising from sanctions against Russia, but can find money for other causes. The EU is providing 9 billion euro to Ukraine to run the country and has sent a separate 2 billion for military equipment. This is in addition to the huge amounts of money being spent on Ukraine by individual member states, most of whom are in NATO, where military spending is also increasing. Not to mention the EU is developing its own army. Citizens say fueling the Ukraine war is costing the EU too much.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful. But, you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Yes, of course we need to end the war. But the problem is nobody knows how to end the war, you know.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, has been facing pressure during a visit to the European Parliament.
NATO, along with the US and the EU, were never a defensive mechanism, not before the war and not after it. They are offensive. Ukraine has been sacrificed for their interests.
Experts warn the growing social crisis in the EU will have dire consequences for the political establishment. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The U.S. Secret Service deleted text messages from January 5th and last 6 years after they were asked by oversight officials investigating the Capitol attack. That is according to the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General that oversees the Secret Service. The Inspector General on Wednesday sent a letter to the House and State Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack. He said that he had requested the messages at the part of the evaluation of events on that date, but he was notified that the messages had been deleted as part of a device replacement program. The Secret Service has denied the claim. The development comes as the probe continues into the Capitol attack carried out by supporters of former U.S. President Donald Trump. He has been accused of inciting the violence to remain in power after losing the election.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com www.vatican.org/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The Mission of the 10th Infallible Imam. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam everybody, and heartiest congratulations to you on a very auspicious day. Today, the 15th of the month of Dhul-Hajjah, happens to be birth anniversary of the 10th infallible guide of the blessed household of Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We have prepared a special program for you in this regard. And before we start, listen to what God Almighty has said in Ayah 7 of Surah Ra'd.
there is a guide for every people. Among the blessings of God, the All-Merciful, is that He never leaves mankind in the state of confusion and without a divinely designated guide. The Prophet of Islam, as the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, indicated on many occasions that the guide after him was his dear cousin and son-in-law, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, followed by the latter's two sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace upon them, the leaders of the youth of paradise. The Prophet said in clear words that in all there will be 12 Imams after him, with the last one reappearing as Qa'im al-Mahdi, peace upon him, in the end times to end oppression on planet Earth by establishing the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. Today, on the 15th of Dhul-Hajjah, we are celebrating the birthday of the 10th of the 12 divinely designated successors of the Seal of Messengers. He was born in the city of Medina in the year 214 AH, corresponding to 828 AD, and was named Ali, in honor of his illustrious ancestor, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. It would be repetitive to say that if his piety earned him the epithet Naqi, or the pure, his wisdom and abilities to lead the faithful brought him the title Hadi, or the guide. Entrusted with imamat at the tender age of 8 years, in the manner of Prophet Yahya or John the Baptist, regarding whom the Noble Quran says he was granted book and the wisdom while still a boy, Imam Hadi, peace upon him, effortlessly stepped into the shoes of his father, Imam Muhammad Taqi, peace upon him, to display his God-given qualities that astounded the tutors appointed for him by the Abbasid Caliph Mu'tasim in a vain bid to brainwash the child and distort the image of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt. The murderous Mu'tasim, who was mostly engaged in wars with the Byzantine Empire, could not further torment the 10th Imam, and nor did his successor Al-Wathiq. Imam Ali An-Naqi, peace upon him, utilized this period to spell out guidelines for the seekers of truth by enlightening their minds, hearts, and souls with the genuine teachings of Islam. At the same time, he was cautious against involving himself in the frequent revolts, many of them from his distant cousins, which rocked the realm and mostly ended in failure to the detriment of the true believers. In those critical times, he bequeathed to the Muslims the bezels of wisdom and cautioned them against the pitfalls, including the deceit of those who styled themselves as Sufi or mystics. Once, while the 10th Imam was in the Prophet's mosque in Medina, a group of Sufis entered, sat in a corner, and began repeating La ilaha illallah, which means there is no God but Allah. Imam Hadi, peace upon him, told his companions to ignore them, saying, Do not pay attention to these deceivers, for they are allies of the devils and destroyers of the bases of religion. They become ascetic to relieve their bodies and watch to hunt cattle. They do not practice rites except to deceive people, and do not decrease food except to cheat the foolish. The worship is but dancing and clapping. and their praises are but singing. No one follows them except the stupid, and no one believes in them except the foolish. These words of the guidance of the 10th Imam hold true to this day when we see all sorts of frivolities by the so-called Sufis or mystics to whom the ignorant flock and are fleeced of their money on a variety of pretexts and weird practices that are against the Shariat. Imam Hadi, peace upon him, during his 34-year mission groomed many scholars from various lands and prepared them for the crucial period of the Qaybat, or occultation of his grandson, the promised Mahdi, peace upon him. Things changed with the seizure of the caliphate by the tyrant Mutawakkil, who was a bitter enemy of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt, and who has earned lasting damnation for his destruction of the holy shrine of Chief of Martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in Karbala. Fearful of the popularity of Imam Hadi, peace upon him, he forced him to leave Medina and come to his capital, Samarra, in Iraq. The Imam had no choice, and he obliged. But on the way, he stopped in Baghdad, where huge congregations came out to greet him as the Prophet's heir. He also visited the tomb of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, in Najaf, and saluted him with a worthy salutation or ziyarat that is recited till this day by the faithful. A passage from this ziyarat reads, O Allah, bless your guardian, the custodian of your religion, the executor of justice after your prophet, Ali ibn Abi Talib, the commander of the true believers, the Imam of the pious, the master of guardians, the successor of your prophet over the whole people, his guardian in life and religion, the great truthful, the distinguisher between the halal and the haram, the supporter of Islam, the destroyer of idols, the assistant and defender of religion. In Samarra, the caliph tried to ridicule the imam, but on every occasion he was overawed by the personality of the prophet's righteous heir and forced to show respect. Although under virtual house arrest, Imam Hadi, peace upon him, continued to play the guiding role for all those who came into contact with him, despite seeing some of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt martyred, such as the scholar Ibn Sakit and his own elder son, Muhammad, whose shrine is a site of pilgrimage at the city of Balad in Iraq. In short, during his 34 years as the divinely designated guide, of which roughly half of the period was spent in Medina and the other half in Samarra, Imam Hadi, peace upon him, spared no efforts to guide the people. His holy shrine, despite the terrorist attacks to which it was subjected a few years ago by the ungodly Takfiris, continues to beckon all those from all over the globe seeking guidance. Since we are on the threshold of the auspicious day of Qadir, on which in the year 10 AH the Prophet, on the express commandment of God Almighty, had proclaimed his worthy cousin and son-in-law, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, as his divinely designated heir, it would not be inappropriate to cite a paragraph from Imam Hadi's famous salutation to the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, on this day. Peace on you, O my guardian, O Commander of the Faithful, O Allah's trustee on His earth, His envoy amongst His creatures, and His conclusive testament to His servants. I testify that you always opposed self-seeking impulses and were committed to God-weariness, that you were well able to suppress your rage and pardon and forgive the people, that you were displeased when God was disobeyed and were pleased when God was obeyed, that you did what you were enjoined with, observed what was committed to your care, preserved what you were entrusted with, communicated that which you were charged with, and awaited what you had been promised. You distributed the public funds equitably and carried out justice amongst the subjects. You knew Allah's law better than the entire creation. But what is more amazing and more atrocious after the denial of your right is the wrongful dispossession of the orchard of Fadak from the Prophet's beloved daughter and your wife Fatima Zahra, the truthful and the pure one, the mistress of the world's women, and the rejection of your testimony and that of your illustrious sons and the progeny of the Mustafa. May Allah's blessings be upon you. While Allah, the Most High, had elevated your rank over the entire Ummah and exalted your station, and He had made manifest your excellence and honored you above all the world's denizens, keeping away all impurity from you and purifying you with utmost purification.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Cyberspace has become an arena for countries to compete with each other and to make investments with material benefits and income for countries' budgets. But it has also turned into an effective weapon like military weapons and has become a threat to the security of national states. This is why countries have begun to invest heavily in this field. According to a study prepared by the Ventrune Cybersecurity magazine, in which the first 500 companies working in the cyber field were counted, America ranks first with 354 companies, followed by 42 Israeli companies, then 21 British companies. The study shows that another 40 Israeli companies are registered in the United States of America for tax reasons, thus bringing the actual number of Israeli cyber companies to 82 out of 500, or 16.4%. This makes Israel genuinely afraid of the emergence of new players in this field, most notably Iran, China, and Russia. Despite Israel's pursuit of excellence in this field by increasing its cyber power, this did not stop it from being exposed to Iranian cyber attacks. Israel accuses Iran of the attack that targeted Aramco in 2012. Again, in 2012, Israel accused Iran of being responsible for the attack that targeted the water stations. Israel then, in alleged retaliation, cyber-attacked the strategic port of Bandar Abbas. Most recently, in an ongoing series of cyber attacks, Israel claims that Iran-based groups successfully obtained credit card details from hundreds of Israelis and proceeded to leak them online. Hackers targeted several tourism agencies in Israel, obtaining the financial information of thousands of customers and sending hundreds of threatening SMS messages to hacked tourist customers. Iran and Israel are testing each other, though, with great caution, as the recent targets indicated Iran's ability to penetrate Israeli cyberspace and that the latter is not well protected. There is consequently real fear in Israel for any war or cyber attack, and this is what preoccupies analysts, political commentators, and military leaders in the occupation entity. It is true that no human life has been lost in these wars so far, because the protective belts used by Israel wants to be very effective. But over time, Iranian attacks may become more complex. For example, if an attack targets the electricity network or internet services in Israel or the banking system, this reflects negatively on the lives of the Israelis, which may cause the collapse of the system in Tel Aviv. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In spite of Israel's pursuit of superiority in the field of cyber power, its most secure firewalls were not enough to not stop it from being exposed to Iranian cyber attacks. Despite the fact that Israeli companies occupy advanced ranks in the field of cyber technology, they still fear Iranian capabilities. And this fear is due to the recent cyber attacks allegedly attributed to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, there is consequently real fear inside of the Israeli entity of any cyber attack, preoccupying its analysts and especially its military leaders, especially amid the escalation of the Israeli and Iranian mutual threats in light of Israel's cyber attacks that aim to disrupt Iran's nuclear facilities. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media. Thank you very much for being with us, Hadi.
Thank you for having
now,
me.
Cyber has increasingly become a space for strategic confrontation between Israel and Iran, two rather advanced states in cyber capabilities over the past decade. In fact, Iran and Israel have engaged in a long-running cyber warfare conflict throughout the very past decade that we have witnessed. What do you think is the real impact of this non-noisy warfare?
Well, first of all, we have to get things clear that it's not noisy, but it does have its repercussions. And it usually comes in tandem with other types of aggressions, at least from the Israeli side. Like, for example, it comes the Stuxnet worm, which targeted the nuclear facilities. It started in 2005 during the Bush administration and continued till 2017. With Obama, it targeted many infrastructures for the nuclear program and came in tandem with assassinations for top nuclear scientists. So it's not very quiet as it may seem. It usually has bigger strategical implications and comes as a big package with other things, as I said, like, for example, assassinations. So That's one part. You can see that, for example, it may come for exposure of private information for some entities. It might come as something to destroy the work of the actual machines that that make the program. For example, the Iranian program, the worm used to target the actual machinery and systems as a base technical level. Whereas this worm itself spread outside of the nuclear program and made a mess to many companies and many individuals around the world, as it was a vulnerability inside most of the systems. Mm-hmm. So it was targeted for Iran, but it made a lot of fuss outside. It made a problem on a nuclear program level and on an individual level, as well as how Iran used to retaliate. They used to target websites relating to the government, to private institutions. They used to target the phones of generals or top leaders in the Israeli army or the intelligence system. So that's how it goes. It goes back and forth, both systems attacking each other, and sometimes you have collateral damage.
But Hadi, from the Israeli side, cyber attacks combined with the cognitive warfare of civilian organizations in Iran aims to create public opinion pressure against the government inside of the Islamic Republic. However, we have seen it before initiated against the Natanz nuclear site in Iran and against the Iranian steel industry just last week. One question everyone wants answered is, how can Iran possibly stop such attacks from becoming a direct risk of human life?
Okay, to stop it directly, to stop the actual attack, it's quite improbable. It can reduce the risk of the attack by employing awareness campaigns for the actual people who work on these systems to limit private use of their internet, to limit. They should put ground rules of how the users or the people working in possible institutions that might be targeted to have a more secure interfacing with their systems, with their laptops, with their phones, even their private ones. They might put systems to do that, to limit the breach, limit the effect of these worms, these viruses, the malware, the ransomware, whatever type of attack they might be doing, on the location or local scale of the attack. To limit the hurt or the effects on their lives, it's a different thing all in all. This should be something followed up by actual intelligence systems to provide the needed protection. For example, if let's say, God forbid, something happens at the nuclear facility and it blows up, this error should be faced before the attack, like evacuation or control systems, policies, etc. So there should be security policies on the internet use, security policies on the systems, mm-hmm. security policies on the actual people who work there, their families, so that they don't get breached through maybe a child playing a game on his gaming system, downloads something which gets attacks his local network, which transfers to his parents' items like mobile phones or laptops, who then themselves take it to their location of work. There are many ways where infiltrations can happen. Mm-hmm. These should be sourced out, they should be noticed, and they should have contingency plans.
Mm-hmm. Well, Hadi, this mutual warfare allows both sides to convey whatever strategic messages that they want, but it also has a price for Israel. A demonstration of cyber attacks capabilities leads to the other side being some sort of vaccinated against such cyber attacks, against those cyber weapons, and generally improving Iran's cyber defenses because they are learning from what's going on. How do you think these attacks and counterattacks will shape the role of cyber warfare in the next decade, because it seems to be intensifying?
Okay, one thing you can notice is, if you step back a little bit, if you can notice that even in media, there are sometimes these call-outs onto these cyber attacks, etc. Like, for example, the Iranian series called Gandu, They had this security attacks, etc. Also on cyber attacks were covered inside this series, which is a fictional series based on true events. Then Israel came, they replied with another TV series called Tehran, which calls out for Israeli spy who infiltrates Iran, and she is herself, she's a hacker. So they are employing this in their fiction as well as in their facts. And also you can see that with each attack, the attack level is higher. That's why, because with practice, people become better or perfect. This recurring attacks from and to will make both sides more powerful, make them even more more creative in how they tackle these things. But this usually involves adding a human element. For example, in the series, they sent the agent to Tehran to be able to infiltrate the firewalls, the mm-hmm. protective systems, so that she interfaces with the actual systems that are linked to the nuclear program, the missile protection or anti-missile systems that protect
the ones which you are usually hard to affect online.
Exactly, have to be accessed directly, like
on location,
through hardware.
On location.
Yeah, and this affects. So they're always adding these ideas that you need this human element, which is used not by actual cyber warfare, but by the intelligence system which implores the cyber warfare. Mm-hmm. So they will be adding people in tandem to this system, not actual online attacks. Or like through proxies, for example, they would target a family. Then the people should be careful who their family interacts with, etc. So it's a very mishmashed thing.
Especially in a world where devices now rule our entire existence. Definitely proves that the upcoming years will be highlighted with maybe more creative
more events, exactly.
Cyber warfare. So I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media, for this compact and inclusive answers that you gave us, which we definitely need in such a new topic. Please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the advances and the capabilities of Ansarullah in Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the leader of the Ansarullah Yemeni resistance, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, announced that as his country enters its eighth year of confronting the U.S.-Saudi aggression, the production of various missiles is continuous and advanced, and it is day after day more accurate and more destructive. Al-Houthi declared that Yemen manufactures long-range ballistic missiles that reach any point in the countries taking part in the coalition of aggression. Yemen enhances its military arsenal in this following report.
The missile force and the unmanned air force have proven to be the absolute force that distinguishes it from the heavy use of ballistic missile defenses more than any conflict in the modern history of wars. Yemen's missiles have so far targeted sensitive sites that have confused the countries of the coalition of aggression and created a scene of panic and anxiety among their military ranks, namely those who possess an integrated military arsenal, especially Patriot missiles, to deter and shoot down ballistic missiles, but are unable so far to stop the attack or change the course of the conflict despite all the technology they possess. Local cadres of Yemen's Ansarullah continue to develop missile capabilities and an air force capable of striking any target in the depth of the countries of the coalition of aggression. Last week, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of the Yemeni revolution, revealed the continued development of Yemen's military capabilities, stressing the failure of American defense systems to confront Yemeni missiles. He said in a televised speech during his meeting with the sheikhs and dignitaries of Hajjah Governorate that Ansarullah are making long-range ballistic missiles
Hamas that can reach any point in the countries of the aggression coalition at the level of neighboring countries. He stressed that the production of various missiles is continuing and developing, and it is becoming more accurate and more destructive day by day. Al-Houthi pointed out that various weapons, from pistols to Kalashnikovs to cannons to missiles, are now manufactured locally, and this is a great achievement that gives hope in various fields. Observers and political analysts said that there is no longer a safe place throughout Saudi geography, as Yemen has the ability to strike the most fortified targets, and that the Saudi regime has no choice but to submit to peace and a comprehensive and just political settlement. The 8-year war on Yemen has proven that the Saudi regime has a poor understanding of Yemen's repeated calls and initiatives for peace, which is what makes it persist in committing crimes against the Yemeni people. However, when the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia receives painful blows at the hands of the valiant Yemeni armed forces in a series of successive deterrence operations, it turns into a complainant to the international community and its masters in Washington, begging for protection. Military experts consider that the Yemenis succeeded in the use of missile power and air force to target their aggressors, and as part of an integrated strategy to increase costs and exhaust the military, economic, and political capabilities of the aggressors, significantly disrupting the economies of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Sydney is Jay Therapil, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Jay. Now, air and missile defense mechanisms in the possession of the forces of aggression did not succeed in eliminating the effectiveness of the Yemeni missiles and the Yemeni military capabilities. However, some Western experts considered Yemen's capabilities only a psychological deterrent to the targeted forces of aggression rather than an actual military deterrent capable of changing the balance of power on the ground. What's your take on this kind of analysis?
The reason why the Yemeni national resistance engages in a combination of drone and missile warfare is to force the Saudis and the Emiratis to pay a price for their genocidal war against Yemen. Therefore, it's not just psychological damage, it's the economic cost that this war is inflicting on the Saudi economy. The Saudis are using interceptor missiles that cost $4.3 million each to shoot down Yemeni drones that cost $1,000 each. As a result, the Saudis have only spent over $400 billion on this war, and this is largely by breaking world records in the use of ballistic missile defenses, which is why the Brookings Institute calls it the greatest use of ballistic missile defenses of any conflict in history. Now, the problem for Saudi Arabia is that ever since the U.S. withdrew their eight Patriot missile defense systems from Saudi Arabia in June last year, the Saudis have been running low on interceptor missiles. And the U.S. and Britain are not interested in giving them missiles because they care, or the only thing they care about right now is getting Saudi Arabia to pump out more oil. So while the Saudis are running out of interceptor missiles, Yemen is manufacturing its own missiles. According to Sayyid Abdelmalek al-Houthi from a week ago, Yemen today manufactures long-range ballistic missiles that can reach any point in the neighboring aggression countries. Or the neighboring aggressive countries, it should say. So Saudi Arabia, despite not being under siege and despite receiving hundreds of billions of dollars in loans and military aid, they are running out of missiles, whereas Yemen, which is under a genocidal siege, which is intended to prevent the resistance from even acquiring weapons, is now pounding Saudi oil installations using its own arsenal of reverse-engineered missiles.
Well, Jay, Yemen has become a force to be reckoned with today in the region, and the entire international community, despite American perseverance, has become certain of the impossibility of the U.S.'s victory or its own puppet's victory inside of Yemen. Given now this fact and with the start of the countdown to the end of the ongoing current truce in Yemen, might extending the truce be in favor of the aggressors than it is in favor of Yemen at the moment?
You can certainly make the argument that this UN brokered truce, which supposedly began in April, favours the Saudi-led aggressors for the simple reason that only the Yemeni national resistance is ever expected to adhere to the terms of the truce, whereas the Saudis violate the truce all the time. Mm-hmm. Up until now, the Yemen Press Agency, which is based in the capital Sana'a, has recorded 169 violations of that truce, which means that the front lines are still very much active and the people of Yemen are still being starved by the blockade. However, ever since the truce was announced in April, the Saudis have refrained from the more brazen acts of aggression, like, you know, wantonly bombing civilian areas using their air force. And there are two reasons, I think, why Saudi Arabia agreed to the truce. And the first reason is because the Yemeni drone and missile attack on Aramco facilities on the 25th of March, which caused an explosion very close to the Formula One Grand Prix. Mm-hmm. After the operation, Ansarullah, through its spokesman Mohammed al-Bukhaiti, indicated that Yemen was sending the message that it had the capability to disrupt the flow of oil. The CEO of Aramco then told the New York Times that the ability of Yemen to hit Saudi oil infrastructure was a real concern for the world. So the Saudis have been openly admitting that they are vulnerable. The second reason is because the major concern for the West right now is oil prices, which I mentioned before. And oil prices peaked at $120 per barrel in June, and it now sits at $100 per barrel, although this price reduction has mostly been achieved in the West, at least, by reducing consumption through raising interest rates rather than increasing production. So the Yemeni resistance has exposed the embarrassing fact that Saudi Arabia does not have any spare capacity when it comes to oil production. 2 days ago, oilprice.com put out a damning report by Simon Watkins that accused Saudi Arabia of grossly exaggerating its capacity for producing crude oil. To give you the big picture, Saudi Arabia has been claiming for the past 30 years that they have about 260 billion barrels of crude oil, and yet they've exported 95 billion barrels since 1973, but they still claim that they have around 260 billion barrels, which is mathematically impossible.
Definitely. But we have another aggressor here in the region that is somehow fearful of Yemen, talking about none other than Israel. It's kind of on its toes analyzing the Yemeni arsenal and the ballistic missiles and the armed drones capabilities. Now, we have the Israeli Institute for National Security Studies claiming that Ansarullah's constant rhetoric against Israel and their accumulation of a large stock of weapons